This week on Making Contact.
They're closing down firehouses and police stations and libraries, but nobody's talking about the billions of dollars that go to Israel.
U.S. government support for Israel has never been stronger, but a consumer boycott of Israel is gaining steam, and wherever they travel, Israeli government officials are being confronted and denounced.
Students are bringing forward divestment initiatives, and we see also anti-Palestinian groups moving against the college campuses.
On this edition, author and activist Ali Abu Nima explains why he thinks Israel has lost the argument over who's right and wrong, and where he thinks the movement to free Palestine is headed next. I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information.
When it comes to Palestine, it's time to leave behind all the things that haven't worked. And we could go back a long time, but I will just go back to a couple of years, to 2008, beginning of 2009, when the wounds of children in Gaza were still burning from white phosphorus, and President Obama took office. And yet many people had hope that this man would bring some semblance of justice or a change to American policy. And even though he remained silent throughout the bombardment of Gaza and still remains silent about it today, in fact, that's not quite true because he defended it. But nevertheless, people saw some hope in the fact that for the first time in a long time, we heard a U.S. administration demand that Israel stop stealing land and building settlements. And he went to Cairo and talked about how important it was to end the occupation. And yet, without going into all that happened in the past 2 years, look at where we are now. We are in a situation where people say, well, you know, what could the president do? Because the political forces are so arrayed against him. And we've heard that on everything. You know, we have millions of people without jobs in this country. We have especially young people. Youth unemployment is over 25%. And among African American youth, it's over 40%, approaching 50%. And people say, well, what can he do? Well, you put up a fight. Nobody asked us to come and fight. Many of us would have been there if we were asked to put up a fight. And the same is true when it comes to Palestine. He never put up a fight. And now we have these claims from the Republicans who, it's so interesting that, you know, for so many decades, U.S. support for Israel was treated as a bipartisan issue. And you didn't see Republicans and Democrats disagreeing about support for Israel. You'd see, you know, John Boehner and Nancy Pelosi standing next to each other, standing behind the Israeli Prime Minister in Congress and agreeing. I mean, I think that, you know, this could have been a really good device to get Congress to do some things. They can't agree on health care reform, call it Israel care, and then they'll agree. You know, you can't get funding for schools, change the name of the schools to Israel, and they'll be funded. You know, we have a situation where in the last budget negotiations, they cut, what was it, $514 million for women and infants for nutrition programs. And nobody's talking about, in this country, they're closing down firehouses and police stations and libraries and cutting pay to teachers. We're told that there's in Congress people saying the United Nations is getting too much funding from the United States. Well, maybe it is, I don't know. But nobody's talking about the billions of dollars that go to Israel. Well, Israelis have health care. They have public health care. So we have this Congress that insists on subsidizing, what is it, socialist health care for Israelis. It's a Congress of socialists, but only when it comes to Israel. So we can't have a discussion about any of these things because right now the Republicans and Democrats are engaged in a competition to see who can be more fanatically pro-Israel. So it would seem that, you know, just as the young people who are in the streets have concluded that you know, waiting till 2012, and if we can just get the House back into Democratic hands, then everything will be okay. And, you know, if people are tired of that, they're saying we have to go and occupy the streets. And we don't know where this will go, but they're leaving the shore. Well, We already understood that when it came to Palestine. And for the past few years, we have seen a growing global solidarity movement. The support for Palestinian rights has always been strong around the world. Our problem has been how to mobilize it, how to turn it into power, how to turn all that latent support into power that can actually bring change. And I think that over the past few years, we've been seeing a movement growing, particularly among Palestinians, a renewed and redoubled steadfastness among Palestinians in every part of Palestine, whether it's Bedouin in the Naqab in the south being driven off their land, another 30,000 who are now being targeted for expulsion from their land in the Naqab region of southern Palestine, whether it is people in the West Bank seeing their land constantly shrinking as settlers take it, or whether it's people in Gaza living under a brutal siege and blockade. And internationally, we've seen growing support for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, and it's growing all the time. You remember a few years ago when we were told BDS will never amount to anything. This will never catch on. This will never make a difference. And there's still a long way to go. But I don't think that the Jewish federations would have allocated, as they did earlier this year, $6 million to fight BDS if they didn't think it was going somewhere. And I think it's very important to understand the phase we are in this struggle. And it's one where we're going to see much more thrown at us, at all of us. I mentioned the escalating efforts, the millions of dollars allocated to fighting this movement for human rights in Palestine. Back in February 2010, the Re'ut Institute, an Israeli think tank closely affiliated with the government, issued a report saying that the greatest threat to Israel was not an invading army, not Iranian nuclear weapons. By the way, just yesterday, Haaretz had a piece saying that the former head of the Mossad, Israel's foreign state-sponsored international death squad, the Mossad, said that Iran was many years away from making a nuclear weapon. They really need to coordinate their propaganda messages better with the prime minister before he goes to make speeches at the United Nations. But in any case, the Ra'ut Institute said that the greatest threat to Israel was what it called delegitimization. That Israel focuses on military threats, but the greatest threat is actually political. It's a threat to the legitimacy of Israel, and that Israel faces the prospect of collapse, like apartheid South Africa or East Germany. The one thing they didn't get is that apartheid South Africa collapsed because apartheid is bad, and people resisted it because it's a bad thing. Not just because there were all these bad people who are, you know, anti-Africana or anti-white, but because there was a struggle for people's rights. But their recommendation was not what my recommendation would have been. Now, if I were making the recommendations, I would say, do justice, and then all of these things you fear will go away. The answer from the Ra'ut Institute, and this was what went out to the Israeli government and the pro-Israel groups around the world, was to sabotage and attack the delegitimizers. Now, interestingly, when we wrote about this report on the Electronic Intifada, we reported on it and we included also a PowerPoint presentation that had been given by Gidi Greenstein, the head of the Ra'ut Institute, in which he said that Israel's intelligence services should engage in sabotage and attack of the Solidarity Movement. They suddenly realized that, you know, this wasn't such a great thing to publish, so they changed the report. But of course we kept copies, and if you go to the Electronic Intifada, you can see the original words calling for sabotage and attack. We've seen also the Irvine 11, 10 students who were hauled before a criminal court in Orange County and prosecuted for protesting a representative of the Israeli government, a former spokesman of the Israeli army during Israel's 2006 bombardment of Lebanon, who had himself taken part in the 1982 invasion of Lebanon that killed tens of thousands of people. And Orange County put the top homicide DA on their case, and they wanted these young people to go to prison. And they were convicted, and they were sentenced to 3 years of probation and 56 hours of community service. But they're unbowed. But that was part of the effort to suppress, to delegitimize protest. In Chicago, just over a year ago, and in Minneapolis and other cities, the FBI came a calling to many of our friends and colleagues and brothers and sisters, and they started issuing subpoenas, and they raided the homes of a number of activists involved in Palestine solidarity work and labor rights work in this country and abroad. And for more than a year, there has been this witch hunt. They never indicted anyone. They never said there was a danger to anyone. In fact, they said the opposite. There's no danger to the public. What we think they're doing, what we're sure they're doing, is a witch hunt against activists who are engaged in international solidarity work. But what they didn't count on, because they subpoenaed more than two dozen people, and you know, if you defy a federal grand jury subpoena, you can go to jail. Nobody has gone to jail yet, and I hope nobody will, because I believe they did not count on the huge national community response. The number of people who came into the streets, who responded to the call in days, and who simply expressed their opposition to this. And I think that's a victory. I think it's because of that public response that they have not dared to put anyone in jail. And I think we have to keep up the pressure.
You're listening to Ali Abu Nima, founder of the Electronic Intifada, speaking in October 2011 in Oakland, California. The event benefited the Middle East Children's Alliance and was presented by KPFA Radio. We'll be right back with more after a break. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the US, Canada, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact.
You look at what's been happening at the universities and the campuses. In less than two weeks, will be the first National Students for Justice in Palestine conference at Columbia University. Is there anyone from here going? Yeah, I can see some hands going up. And this is incredibly important because students time and again prove to be the conscience of a society, the ones who demand that issues that no one wants to talk about be put on the agenda. And so students are bringing forward divestment initiatives on their campuses, and not just about Palestine, but the whole range of US militarism empire around the world, the role of arms companies, and the close connections between universities and the military establishment is being put in the spotlight by students. And we see also the anti-Palestinian groups moving against the college campuses. And we see a very disturbing trend taking shape that it's very, I think, important to understand. Just in the past few days, it was revealed that the United States Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights was launching an investigation at Columbia University, coincidence of coincidences, based on an alleged claim that a student's civil rights had been violated because she was steered away from a course given by Professor Joseph Messad. This has nothing to do with Professor Joseph Messad, and the university issued a strong statement saying that. But what it does have to do with is that those bringing the civil rights complaint are members of a national pro-Israel group, Scholars for Peace in the Middle East. And what the key person is himself a former head of the Office of Civil Rights, who now works for a pro-Israel organization. And what we've seen is a pattern of using Title VI civil rights legislation, which was designed to turn back and protect students from the institutionalized racism that existed in the pre-civil rights period, to use that legislation to silence discussion of Israeli apartheid. In other words, to use civil rights legislation to protect racism and apartheid. And the first case, the first investigation by the OCR, the Office of Civil Rights, started here in California at UC Santa Cruz in March. And the Chronicle of Higher Education reported that the investigation was opened because of speech critical of Israel on campus. The legal theory that's being used, basically, I'm paraphrasing it, since criticism of Israel is anti-Semitism, then criticism of Israel on campus is a violation of the civil rights of Jewish students. I mean, I think that's an anti-Semitic argument because it automatically assumes that all Jewish people identify with Israel and identify with Israel's racist ideology, and we know that that's not the case. But from UC Santa Cruz, we discovered in August, we published a story in the Electronic Intifada that Stand With Us, another national pro-Israel group, was preparing a similar civil rights complaint against Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. Evergreen State was the college attended by Rachel Corrie. And the students at Evergreen State had passed a resolution last year calling on Evergreen State to divest from Israel. So, to divest from particular companies, not just generally from Israel, but they had identified the companies, including Caterpillar, that made the bulldozer that the Israeli army used to murder Rachel Corrie. The students at her college wanted their college's money out of Caterpillar. What was so interesting about what we discovered from documents that were not supposed to be published, but Stand With Us had accidentally published online, they were engaged, they're preparing this civil rights complaint against Evergreen State, and they were planning a lawsuit, which they've now filed. We believe they filed it because we revealed their plan to do so, against the Olympia Food Co-op, which also took a historic decision to respond to the Palestinian call for boycott and to deshelve Israeli goods. Two things are interesting about this. First of all of these things were discussed in person between Stand With Us and a representative of the Israeli government, the Consul General in San Francisco, Akiva Tor, who actually went up to Olympia to meet with the plaintiffs who were going to file the lawsuit, who did eventually file the lawsuit against Olympia, and to discuss the civil rights complaint against Evergreen State. You might wonder how it is that the representative of a foreign government is getting involved in these issues, but we believe this is not a coincidence. I think that this is part of a pattern and a policy. I'm telling you all of this because we're going to face more of this, and it is coming at us more and more. But the second important and interesting thing about all of these things is what they don't deal with. Have you noticed? The effort to suppress the Olympia Food Co-op boycott, the lawsuit, is procedural. They're not arguing about Israeli policies or whether boycott is right or wrong. They're claiming that the board did not follow the proper procedures. With the Irvine 11, they didn't want to talk about the rights and wrongs of a representative. I mean, they're talking about the free speech rights of Michael Oren, the Israeli ambassador. He wasn't there to give his personal opinion. He was there to represent a state and a government engaged in crimes. It's not as if the Israeli government doesn't have enough opportunities to make its views heard in the United States. They didn't want to talk about that. So they prosecuted the students under an obscure law about disrupting public meetings. The civil rights complaints, the same pattern. They tried to change the focus away from what the students and faculty who are being targeted want to talk about, which is what's happening in Palestine and the US role, to saying that your actions are making students on this campus feel uncomfortable. And all of this is about changing the subject. And what it tells us is that they understand something very important, that they have lost the argument. And we are winning the argument, because the arguments for Palestinian rights are the arguments for the rights and dignity of all human beings. They're arguments that say that in the 21st century, you cannot have a situation where a grandmother born in Palestine is not allowed to return to her home, to her village, just because she's not a Jew. Whereas somebody from San Francisco or Canada or Argentina who's never set foot in Palestine is allowed to go and settle there and take people's land and receive all kinds of state funding simply because of some arbitrary designation. Would we accept that if it was about skin color? Would we say, oh, well, you know, this is very reasonable. We have to understand their fears. So in the 21st century, these arguments don't stand and they can't be won. We are winning the argument, and we are facing increasingly these kinds of bullying and intimidation measures that I think, if we're aware of them, if we're smart, if we're united, we'll defeat. They won't stop us. It's not as if they're going to stop us or intimidate us or prevent us from continuing to fight for what we believe in. There will have been more attempts to turn us back towards the shore we left, but I have no doubt that we are very much going to keep trying to leave every time, and we are eventually, and in the not too distant future, going to reach the other side. Thank you.
That was Electronic Intifada founder Ali Abunima speaking in October 2011 in Oakland, California. You can hear a full-length version of his speech, along with questions and answers, and an introduction by author Alice Walker at our website, radioproject.org. And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to the Middle East Children's Alliance and KPFA Radio in Berkeley. And thanks to Left Tilt for helping fund this program. For a CD copy of this show, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736 or check out our website at radioproject.org to get a podcast, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. Like Making Contact on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. Lisa Rudman is our executive director. Hyunjin Lee and Esther Mania are producers. Irene Flores, web editor. Steph St. Clair, development associate. Lisa Bartfai and Christopher Holmbach, production interns. Barbara Barnett, Dan Turner, Megan LaSala, Ron Rucker, Alton Bird, Catherine Brousseau, and Daishal Moore, volunteers. I'm Andrew Stelzer. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.